About anger. October 2014. 1. Saiva indignatio. In the consciousness-raising days of the second wave of feminism, we made a big deal out of anger, the anger of women. We praised it and cultivated it as a virtue. We learned to boast of being angry, to swagger our rage, to play the fury. We were right to do so. We were telling women who believed they should patiently endure insults, injuries, and abuse that they had every reason to be angry. We were rousing people to feel and see injustice, the methodical mistreatment to which women were subjected, the almost universal disrespect of the human rights of women, and to resent and refuse it for themselves and for others. Indignation, forcibly expressed, is an appropriate response to injustice. Indignation draws strength from outrage, and outrage draws strength from rage. There is a time for anger, and that was such a time. Anger is a useful, perhaps indispensable, tool in motivating resistance to injustice. But I think it is a weapon, a tool useful only in combat and self-defense. People to whom male dominance is important or essential fear women's resistance, therefore women's anger. They know a weapon when they see one. The backlash from them was immediate and predictable. Those who see human rights as consisting of men's rights labeled every woman who spoke up for justice as a man-hating, bra-burning, intolerant shrew. With much of the media supporting their view, they successfully degraded the meaning of the words feminism and feminist, identifying them with intolerance to the point of making them almost useless even now. The far right likes to see everything in terms of warfare. If you look at the feminism of 1960 through 1990 that way, you might say it worked out rather like the Second World War. The people who lost it gained a good deal in the end. These days, overt male dominance is less taken for granted. The gender gap in take-home pay is somewhat narrower. There are more women in certain kinds of high positions, particularly in higher education. Within certain limits and in certain circumstances, girls can act uppity and women can assume equality with men without risk. As the old ad with the cocky bimbo smoking a cigarette said, "You've come a long way, baby." Oh, gee, thanks, boss. Thanks for the lung cancer, too. Perhaps, to follow the nursery metaphor instead of the battlefield one, if feminism was the baby, she's now grown past the stage where her only way to get attention to her needs and wrongs was anger, tantrums, acting out, kicking ass. In the cause of gender rights, mere anger now seldom proves a useful tool. Indignation is still the right response to indignity, to disrespect, but in the present moral climate, it seems to be most effective expressed through steady, resolute, morally committed behavior and action. This is clearly visible in the issue of abortion rights, where the steadfast nonviolence of rights defenders faces the rants, threats, and violence of rights opponents. The opponents would welcome nothing so much as violence in return. If NARAL vented rage as Tea Party spokesmen do, if the clinics brandished guns to defend themselves from the armed demonstrators, the opponents of abortion rights on the Supreme Court would hardly have to bother dismantling Roe v. Wade by degrees, as they're doing. The cause would be already lost. As it is, it may suffer a defeat, but if we who support it hold firm, it will never be lost. Anger points powerfully to the denial of rights, but the exercise of rights can't live and thrive on anger. It lives and thrives on the dogged pursuit of justice. If women who value freedom are dragged back into open conflict with oppression, forced to defend ourselves against the reimposition of unjust laws, we will have to call on anger as a weapon again. But we're not at that point yet, and I hope nothing we do now brings us closer to it. Anger continued on past its usefulness becomes unjust, then dangerous. Nursed for its own sake, valued as an end in itself, it loses its goal. It fuels not positive activism, but regression, obsession, vengeance, self-righteousness. Corrosive, it feeds off itself, destroying its host in the process. The racism, misogyny, and counter-rationality of the reactionary right in American politics for the last several years is a frightening exhibition of the destructive force of anger deliberately nourished by hate, encouraged to rule thought, invited to control behavior. I hope our republic survives this orgy of self-indulgent rage. To private anger. I've been talking about what might be called public anger, political anger, but I went on thinking about the subject as a personal experience, getting mad, being angry, and I find the subject very troubling because though I want to see myself as a woman of strong feeling but peaceable instincts, I have to realize how often anger fuels my acts and thoughts, how very often I indulge in anger. I know that anger can't be suppressed indefinitely without crippling or corroding the soul, but I don't know how useful anger is in the long run. Is private anger to be encouraged? Considered a virtue, given free expression at all times, as we wanted women's anger against injustice to be, what would it do? Certainly an outburst of anger can cleanse the soul and clear the air, but anger nursed and nourished begins to act like anger suppressed. It begins to poison the air with vengefulness, spitefulness, distrust, breeding grudge and resentment, brooding endlessly over the causes of the grudge, the righteousness of the resentment. A brief, open expression of anger in the right moment, aimed at its true target, is effective. Anger is a good weapon, but a weapon is appropriate to, justified only by, a situation of danger. Nothing justifies cowing the family every night with rage at the dinner table, or using a tantrum to settle the argument about what TV channel to watch, or expressing frustration by tailgating and then passing on the right at 80 miles per hour yelling, "Fuck you!" Perhaps the problem is this. When threatened, we pull out our weapon, anger. Then the threat passes or evaporates, but the weapon is still in our hand, and weapons are seductive, even addictive. They promise to give us strength, security, dominance. Looking for positive sources or aspects of my own anger, I recognized one, self-respect. When slighted or patronized, I flare up in fury and attack right then, right there. I have no guilt about that. But then, so often it turns out to have been a misunderstanding. The disrespect was not intended or was mere clumsiness perceived as a slight. And even if it was intended, so what? As my great-aunt Betsy said of a woman who snubbed her, I pity her poor taste. Mostly my anger is connected less with self-respect than with negatives, jealousy, hatred, fear. Fear in a person of my temperament is endemic and inevitable, and I can't do much about it except recognize it for what it is and try not to let it rule me entirely. If I'm in an angry mood and aware of it, I can ask myself, "So what is it you're afraid of?" That gives me a place to look at my anger from. Sometimes it helps get me into clearer air. Jealousy sticks its nasty yellow-green snout mostly into my life as a writer. I'm jealous of other writers who soar to success on wings of praise, I'm contemptuously angry at them, at the people who praise them. If I don't like their writing, I'd like to kick Ernest Hemingway for faking and posturing when he had the talent to succeed without faking. I snarl at what I see as the unending overestimation of James Joyce. The enshrinement of Philip Roth infuriates me. But all this jealous anger happens only if I don't like what they write. If I like a writer's writing, praise of that writer makes me happy. I can read endless appreciations of Virginia Woolf. A good article about José Saramago makes my day. So evidently the cause of my anger isn't so much jealousy or envy as, once again, fear. Fear that if Hemingway, Joyce, and Roth really are the greatest, there's no way I can ever be very good or very highly considered as a writer. Because there's no way I am ever going to write anything like what they write, or please the readers and critics they please. The circular silliness of this is self-evident, but my insecurity is incurable. Fortunately, it operates only when I read about writers I dislike, never when I'm actually writing. When I'm at work on a story, nothing could be farther from my mind than anybody else's stories or status or success. Anger's connection with hatred is surely very complicated, and I don't understand it at all. But again, fear seems to be involved. If you aren't afraid of someone or something threatening or unpleasant, you can, as a rule, despise it, ignore it, or even forget it. If you fear it, you have to hate it. I guess hatred uses anger as fuel. I don't know. I don't really like going to this place. What I am coming away from it with, though, seems to be a pervasive idea that anger is connected with fear. My fears come down to fear of not being safe, as if anyone is ever safe, and of not being in control, as if I ever was in control. Does the fear of being unsafe and not in control express itself as anger, or does it use anger as a kind of denial of the fear? One view of clinical depression explains it as sourced in suppressed anger. Anger turned, perhaps, against the self because fear of being harmed and fear of doing harm, prevents the anger from turning against the people or circumstances causing it. If so, no wonder a lot of people are depressed, and no wonder so many of them are women. They are living with an unexploded bomb. So how do you defuse the bomb, or when and how can you explode it safely, even usefully? A psychologist once informed my mother that a child should not be punished in anger. To be useful, he said, punishment must be administered calmly, with a clear and rational explanation to the child of the cause of punishment. Never strike a child in anger, he said. It sounded so right, my mother said to me. But then I thought, was he telling me to hit a kid when I'm not angry? This was shortly after my daughter Caroline, a sweet-natured, affectionate 2-year-old, came up to me while the family was sitting around on the terrace outside my parents' house. She smiled up at me rather uncertainly and bit me hard on the leg. My left arm swung out in full backhand and knocked her away like a fly. She was unhurt, but enormously surprised. There were then, of course, many tears, many hugs, many consolations. There were no apologies on either side. I only got guilty about hitting her later. That was terrible, I said to my mother. I didn't think. I just whacked her. My mother then told me about what the psychologist had told her, and she said, when your brother Clifton was 2, he bit me, and he kept doing it. I didn't know what to do. I thought I shouldn't punish him. Finally, I just blew up. I slapped him. He was so surprised, like Caroline. I don't think he even cried. And he stopped biting. If there is a moral to this tale, I don't know what it is. I see in the lives of people I know how crippling a deep and deeply suppressed anger is. It comes from pain and it causes pain. Maybe the prolonged festival of cruelty going on in our literature and movies is an attempt to get rid of repressed anger by expressing it, acting it out symbolically. Kick everybody's ass all the time. Torture the torturer. Describe every agony. Blow up everything over and over. Does this orgy of simulated or virtual violence relieve anger or increase the leaden inward load of fear and pain that causes it? For me, the latter. It makes me sick and scares me. Anger that targets everything and everybody indiscriminately is the futile, infantile, psychotic rage of the man with an automatic rifle shooting preschoolers. I can't see it as a way of life, even pretended life. You hear the anger in my tone? Anger indulged rouses anger. Yet anger suppressed breeds anger. What is the way to use anger to fuel something other than hurt, to direct it away from hatred, vengefulness, self-righteousness, and make it serve creation and compassion?